"This is a republic if you can keep it," with former Democratic Party Chairman Mark Brewer and former Republican Party Executive Director Jeff Timmer.
I'm Mark Brewer. This is I Wish I Owned a TV Station, edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It, with station owners throughout Michigan about the only ones who are happy with the tens of millions, and I expect well over $100 million that is end up going to be spent by campaigns across Michigan as these television stations take their once every 2 year opportunity to gouge all of us. We're less than 2 weeks away from Election Day. About 750,000 ballots have already been voted, absentee ballots, and another million absentee ballots have been issued.
I'm Jeff Timmer. November 8th may be Election Day, but the election is very likely to drag on for maybe weeks in Michigan and across the country as losing Republican candidates scream stolen election. We'll talk about election integrity as well as the growing rumblings of Election Day intimidation and violence with the state's leading authority on election laws, Chris Thomas. Thomas served as director of elections for 36 years under both Republican and Democratic secretaries of state. But first, let's talk a little bit about debates and polls and everything that's going on as we head into these last 2 weeks of the campaign. Mark, we've had the second showdown between Governor Gretchen Whitmer and Republican Tudor Dixon last night. Your thoughts on the impact of the debate?
Well, I think it was really just a rehash of what we saw in the first debate in Grand Rapids a couple weeks ago. The exchanges were a little sharper, and there were some good zingers, I think, especially by Governor Whitmer, particularly when she talked about how Tudor Dixon believes it's more important to ban books than to protect our kids from guns in school. She had a better way of saying it than I just did, but I thought it was a great line that really contrasts the views on the two of them, and somehow books are more dangerous than guns. I think that's a little bit closer to what the governor actually said. You know, I don't think it's going to have much effect on the race. You know, for Tudor Dixon, who has had such a deficit, I mean, enormous deficit of being on the air, this may be the first and only time a lot of voters are going to see her. I mean, she didn't fall over. She didn't drool. So, I mean, she stood there on the stage for an hour, didn't do anything, I think, to reach out to the middle of the electorate. This seems for her and the Republicans to be about appealing to not just the base of the Republican Party, Jeff, but the MAGA base of the Republican Party. You know, with all the things that we're hearing there about the conspiracy theories and election denial and, you know, the culture war stuff. So again, I mean, she's obviously committed to that path. She didn't deviate from it last night. So, you know, for the true believers, I'm sure that had some appeal, but I doubt it had any appeal to anybody else. But, you know, what's your take, Jeff?
When you look at the whole issue of debates in state elections versus a presidential election, I think people actually watch presidential debates. Relative to the number of people who will vote, virtually no one will have watched the debate. They will, however, read how it was reported. And I think it's, if anybody's being intellectually honest, Tudor Dixon is the underdog in this campaign. Every single poll, public, private, has shown Gretchen Whitmer with the lead. The only question is how big that lead is and whether or not Dixon can overcome it by Election Day. So that being said, she has to change the trajectory of this race. And so the only real question to me is, did she do anything to alter the dynamics in this race? And I don't think there's any way you can legitimately claim that she did, that she landed that punch, you know, rhetorical punch, that she did that Whitmer committed any gaffes. At the best, you could claim that this was a draw, that each side, whoever you favored going into the debate, if you're watching it or if you're watching the coverage, you're going to come out of this no different of an attitude toward your candidate. That's what I think is that it didn't matter. It didn't change anything. And therefore, because it didn't change anything, Dixon lost. She had to change something, right, or this election is likely to not go her way, because poll after poll after poll after poll, and we can argue with others about the efficacy of polling and how accurate it is, but the trend, the clear trend, is Whitmer has led in every single poll done by every single pollster, regardless of which side they come from, or if media source, anything. Nothing has shown Tudor Dixon ahead in this race, and I doubt anything legitimate ever will show Tudor Dixon ahead in this race.
Now, good points, Jeff. And you and I talked about this in advance of the first debate, where Dixon really needed to land a haymaker or two, if we can use a little boxing metaphor here. And you're right, she didn't. I think Whitmer effectively parried every shot at her. But Whitmer was not being defensive, though. I mean, she had good answers and she had good comebacks in terms of it. So I agree with you. I don't really think it changed the dynamic of the race. But let's talk about a race in which the dynamics may have changed. I want you to give us an update on what's going on in the Attorney General's race, where we have this crazy election denier. I think he's a crook, frankly, and hopefully the courts will ultimately reach that same conclusion. Matt DiPerno versus our current Attorney General. What's going on there?
I'll stick with my polling here. All the polls have shown that of the three statewide constitutional races, the race for Attorney General has been polling the closest. There, too, Matt DiPerno has trailed Dana Nessel, the incumbent, in every single poll done by every single pollster. The Republicans certainly do not have any polls privately that show Matt DiPerno ahead, or they wouldn't be private. They would be out trumpeting this. Matt DiPerno is clearly behind. And it's been reported quite a bit that the Dana Nessel, as well as Jocelyn Benson and Gretchen Whitmer, have significantly more financial resources for their campaigns than do the Republicans. Matt DiPerno and his allies at the Republican Attorney General's Association haven't been on the air yet with any advertising. People have no idea what a Matt DiPerno is. The only thing they're hearing about a Matt DiPerno is that it's a really shitty lawyer, because that's what they're hearing from the Nessel and ads from her allies. Anyway, to get to the news that is somewhat new here, the Republican Attorney General's Association, which is a outside third-party organization that assists people like Matt DiPerno in Michigan and Republican candidates in other states, had pre-booked and had reserved a bunch of television advertising time for the last 2 weeks, 10 days of the campaign. And they are now canceling that advertising altogether. In fact, I mean, the only place they have any airtime booked at all is a smattering, not even a significant amount of television buy in the Detroit market for next week. But given that they just pulled like more than $1 million out of the Grand Rapids market, and apparently have put that money behind the Republican candidate in Georgia, where they added $1.2 million yesterday, it looks like they're bailing. The folks in Washington, the national folks, are looking at the national chessboard and seeing the opportunity just isn't there for them in Michigan. And they're looking at adding to their investments in Georgia, in Arizona, in Nevada, and surprisingly in Minnesota, where it looks like the Democrat incumbent attorney general Keith Ellison is in trouble. That's where the money looks to be going. It looks like Matt DiPerno is going to be heading into the last 2 weeks of the campaign naked on the air. God, that sounds awful. that gets into the definition of obscenity when you see it. So people listening to this, this is when you, defenders of democracy, people who are concerned about the rule of law, this isn't time to let up. If Republicans are pulling up some money here, if they don't put money behind Matt DiPerno, if they don't put money behind Christina Caramo or Tudor Dixon, that doesn't mean that the Democrats can go, you know, we've dodged a bullet and we can now kind of coast through these next, 12, 13 days of the campaign. Now is when you put the pedal down harder to the floor and really drive through the checkered flag. That's the admonition I would give all the campaigns out there.
No, I couldn't agree with you more, Jeff. And I've seen this in my party over the years, and we have a tendency to relax when we think we've got a lead or our opponents have backed off in some way, and that would be a terrible mistake. The fact that DiPerno's got an R behind his name is going to get him a fair percentage of the vote, probably in the mid-40s, just because of that, because the electorate is so polarized that people are just going to vote for somebody, even if he was the devil incarnate, and he's pretty close to that. but he's going to get that vote, even if people don't know who he is, because he's got the R behind his name. So you're right. This is not the time for Dana Nessel or any of the Democratic candidates to let up. It's the time to really accelerate and, like I said, you know, drive through the finish line on Election Day. We'll have to see how this all plays out. And I think Karamo is actually in even a worse position. Nobody had ever reserved any airtime for her. And the ads that have been out there about her in terms of, you know, abortion is child sacrifice and Satanism and all that, and she just has come across as
demon sex.
Yeah, the person that she really is, which is completely crazy and bonkers, and you don't want Michigan elections being run by her. But again, I think Betson's just got to keep pushing and pushing and pushing, and Democrats have got to make sure now that we get the vote out. And that's, again, sometimes where my party has fallen down over the years, taking elections for granted, taking parts of our voting base for granted, not talking to them, and not making sure that they vote. From what I'm hearing inside my party, I don't think people are acting that way this year.
Anybody who thinks you can let off the gas, go read about President Hillary Clinton.
Right, or I'm dating myself, Governor Jim Blanchard and John Engler back in 1990. Right. I mean, I got to tell you, Blanchard should have won that race, but for a variety of reasons, you know, John Engler became governor and dramatically changed Michigan history. That's how much elections can affect history, and that'll be what will happen here. I mean, the differences between Whitmer and Dixon and DiPerno and Nessel and Karamo and Benson, you know, it's night and day. It's night and day, and we're going to have tremendously looking, very different looking state if one or more of them get elected.
Yeah, I mean, people insist that they're of the same species, but I have no evidence of that.
No, they've got that R behind their name, but other than that, Jeff, you know, they've completely shanghaied your old party, and it's now in the hand of these MAGA deniers.
Mark, if we could, let's just spend a couple of minutes, looking at where the Republicans moving money in the Attorney General's race out of Michigan and into places like Minnesota or Arizona or Georgia. I mean, I think that the follow the money really does tell you the picture of how the parties really see the elections and what is really happening. And there's been a shift in this national news coverage, and it filters down into state coverage, that in the last couple of weeks, the Republicans have found their footing, that economy and inflation are eclipsing abortion as the biggest issue in the campaign. I don't think any sane person has ever said the economy and inflation are not big issues in the campaign. And every candidate is out there talking about them in some way, shape, or form. But I think when you look at where the money is going, not just here in Michigan, you can look at it in the battle for control of the legislature or in the congressional races. But when you look across the country, the money tells the tale, and the Republicans are still spending a lot more money in defense of seats that they hold than they are playing offense. And even in races for governor, they're spending more money to defend the governorship in Arizona and to defend the governorship in places like Georgia, and having to move money into Texas, and Ron DeSantis in Florida sucking up money. And now Kevin Stitt, the incumbent governor of Oklahoma, looks on the brink of losing Oklahoma. I mean, Oklahoma is arguably, you know, in any given election, the reddest state out there.
Right.
But the Republicans now might be picking up the governorship in Oregon, which is, kind of like suburban Seattle with the, you know, it's very left coast, very progressive. Democrats have controlled Oregon forever. And the reason they're able to, that the Republican is poised to win there, and even in the game, is because there's an independent / Democrat on the ballot there who is bifurcating the Democratic support. And so the Republican is ahead, but kind of at about like 40-42% of the vote. But the 60% of the vote is being split among an actual Democrat and then a Democrat running as an independent and backed by Phil Knight from Nike. So there's a lot of money that has gone into that independent campaign. And so there's factors that are involved there, but money is going into places like Republican money into Oregon, into Oklahoma, into Arizona, where they're playing defense, and not going into places like Michigan or Pennsylvania. Certainly, there is some money going into Wisconsin, which is, I think, an existential pivot state for American democracy here. But when you look at the battle for the U.S. Senate, the battle for the U.S. House, and the battle for the governorship and secretaries of state and attorneys general, that really tells the story how these national organizations that are these outside funders are moving their money around. And it really shows a much, much closer battle, that there has not been any dramatic shift in these last couple of weeks. And I would still overall, in the macro sense, rather be the Democrats than the Republicans. And that's really, really weird, given the environment that we're in a midterm election. The fact that the Democrats are competing and maybe going to be winning in many of these races, in most of these races, is extraordinary considering where we were as recently as May or June.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Democrats should be looking at something that's comparable to what happened to us in 2010, you know, given the environment that we were in. But you're right, for a variety of reasons. I think the abortion issue, strong incumbents like we've got here, us Democrats, the fundraising disadvantage and so forth has really, you know, kind of has leveled the playing field, I think. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this all plays out on election day. But you're right. You follow the money. There are some Democrats in solid blue districts in the Congress who are suddenly in trouble. So there's a little bit of that going on my side of the aisle as well, though not as much as what you have indicated is going on the Republican side. Yeah. And I think what you just shared with us in terms of Attorney General's Association pulling its money here is an indication of that, that there are places where they are playing defense and they need that money and they've chosen not to invest in somebody like a Matt DiPerno.
Next up, veteran former state elections director Chris Thomas. After these messages on A Republic, If You Can Keep It.
When candidates and government leaders need the facts about their voters, they turn to practical political consulting.
PPC has served political candidates, organizations, campaigns, and businesses for more than 45 years. They work with savvy campaigns to provide the best voter lists available in Michigan, as well as campaign consulting, graphic design, and polling at competitive prices.
Over their storied history, PPC has worked with thousands of campaigns, providing them with, as the New York Times once said, quote, the best lists possible in this competitive state, along with unique and individualized strategy.
They've worked with small campaigns for rural school board, all the way up to occupants of the White House. They are also renowned for their work with ballot initiatives, both for challenges and protections.
Find out more. Go to www.practicalpoliticalconsulting.com or call 517-351-5105.
Epic MRA is pleased to be a sponsor of this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm whose principals have more than four decades of experience measuring public opinion on federal, state, and local issues, from who's ahead in a race for governor or Congress, to local support for a proposed zoning change.
Our clients include media outlets, school districts, state agencies, local governments, and membership organizations across the state. Whether it's measuring voter opinions about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation enjoys public support, Epic MRA has been Michigan's premier go-to pollster for 30 years.
Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at The A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
We're back. And joined by Michigan's number one nonpartisan elections expert and a nationally recognized expert as well, Chris Thomas. Chris served as the state's election director for 36 years under both Republican and Democratic secretaries of state. He administered the Michigan election law, the Campaign Finance Act, and the lobbyist disclosure law, and served as secretary to the Board of State Canvassers. He began his election administration career in 1974 in Washington, D.C., with a clerk of the U.S. House of Representatives and with the Federal Election Commission before joining the Michigan Bureau of Elections in 1982.
In 2013, President Obama appointed Thomas as a commissioner on the Presidential Commission on Election Administration, which made recommendations to improve the election day experience of America's voters. Thomas earned a BA in political science from Michigan State University, go green, an MA in urban affairs from St. Louis University in St. Louis, Missouri, and a JD from Thomas Cooley Law School. And I can tell you, having served on the Board of State Canvassers, the only time I ever got in any trouble is when I didn't listen to Chris Thomas. The guy knows his stuff better, as good as anybody in the country. He's truly an expert.
Well, Chris, thank you very much for being with us. Not only are you a treasure here in Michigan, but you're a nationally recognized expert on elections. And we really appreciate you taking the time and your busy schedule to be with us. I'm going to cut right to it. What are your fears on Election Day in a couple of weeks and thereafter when it comes to the elections here in Michigan?
Well, speaking today on this date, it'll be the 26th of October, you know, I've got Schwartzel's opinion out there while it's on appeal or seeking a stay, causes me a lot of concerns from a variety of reasons. You know, the first thing in his opinion that talks about allowing anybody that's in the count board to use their phone. Not just to bring it into the room, but use it. Now, we've always, until recently, yeah, we've allowed people to bring their phones in, but we don't let them use it. So if we see somebody pull a phone out, we know that, and we can take corrective actions. Well, when you've got a judge says you can use the phone, how are we going to know whether they're calling their mom or making a purchase on Amazon or calling some political operative to relay information about what's going on inside? There's no way we can enforce that. So by the black letter of his opinion, in my view, that's an unenforceable provision now.
Well, explain a little bit to many of our listeners aren't as steeped in this as we are, and why that is a problem.
Yes. Excuse me. So I think we're the only state in the nation, I'm pretty confident of this, that sequesters everybody, including workers and challengers, on election day when the tally begins until 8 o'clock when the polls close. We are sequestered inside. We're not to communicate any information, particularly about results, outside of the room to anyone that could use it for whatever purposes, just to publish it or say, oh, the trend line is this or that. So that's the way it's been, and it's been that way for decades. This is nothing new. And so we've dealt with things all the way, you know, you go back, you know, handheld camcorders came out in the late 80s, early 90s. And we had to deal with that, both in the precinct and the counting boards. Then, of course, cell phones. That was the big one. They wanted, if you can do videos on there, you can do recording, you can do photography, all number of things. And it, in both cases, they can be used and be perceived as intimidating. In a polling place, voters would be intimidated by photography, taking their pictures. In the count boards, the workers are intimidated. And now we have another thing that really adds to this, is that I'm not accusing the challengers as necessarily trying to harass or threaten inspectors. They might, but I'm not accusing them of that. But I do know that when they post those pictures on social media, people are going to be looking for their names, addresses, And we now know post 2020 that it is now common for people to be harassed and threatened on the internet, telephone, through the mail, basically spread by social media. So that's our real concern, is that, you know, it's gotten to that point. Now, that judge didn't say that you can do photography. He didn't say that's not stated in there. But I know Patrick Kobach. He's out there. You can find it on Twitter saying, oh, this is an unfettered right now to do photography, record everything. And that is going to be a flashpoint that leads to potential violence. You start sticking phones after you harass, you know, yell at people if they do what they did in 2020, and then go stick a phone in their face to start taking their pictures. We're going to have problems. So that's my short-term fear. Now, I'm hoping that the appellate courts, you know, both Court of Appeals and Supreme Court will back off of this. This is, you know, sir, you guys know about the Purcell rule and all of that. I mean, this is way too late in the calendar to be entertaining these kinds of cases. Now, I get that the revised Judicature Act says, you know, 28 days. These guys tiptoed right up to that. But you can't start retooling all kinds of things at this late date. And these people, these plaintiffs, all had this document. Certainly had it in May from the Secretary of State. We referred to it in the Q&A we handed out in Detroit in the primary. So this should be nothing new to them. You know, why they sat on their hands until late September, you almost have to imagine that it was strategy.
Sure. We have to be really concerned. And just to be, you know, doubly, triply clear here, that we're talking about the processing of absentee ballots and counting on Election Day. And this seems to me to be kind of the equivalent of what we're witnessing in Arizona, where people are masked and armed outside of drop boxes. You know, they're 100 feet away or 300 feet away or whatever the law requires, but they claim they're not there to intimidate or disrupt. They're just there to observe. Because naturally, everybody would just be there to observe, you know, in a completely peaceful way, you know, wearing a mask and tactical gear and carrying a gun. But what we're talking about here is disruption, planned chaos, using, in this case, the threat, the prospect of doxing people online, putting their safety in danger, their family in danger. There's many, many reasons why we've had these safeguards. It all comes down to when they say that they plan to disrupt the election in ways like this, we should believe them and take them at their word. And this ruling seems to give them a blank check to stretch that limit and see what kind of mayhem they can cause.
Yeah, and what this ruling shows, I mean, it really is the poster child for why you shouldn't have late litigation. It shows that the confusion it causes allows people to work kind of slippery with the whole slope there, coming up with interpretations that were not stated in the opinion itself. And so... You know, if nothing were to change, you know, we'd be sitting here going, all right, Sunday comes, pre-processing begins, and we know we're going to have a showdown probably within an hour and probably at the door over cell phones. And, you know, that stuff should all be resolved in the books well before election.
Yeah. And, you know, we're going to, Mark, I'm sorry, I've jumped in here too many times. Please go ahead.
Chris, you know, there was another aspect of Secretary Benson's guidance that Judge Schwartzel also blocked, and I was curious about your thoughts on this. We all know that, you know, people can be challenged in the right to vote. Very, very narrow grounds. Very narrow. And you have to have proof. But it seems like folks are winding up to go in there to polling places, even absentee county boards, and just gum up the works by making a lot of frivolous challenges to slow everything down. And in the judge's opinion, he said, you know, you have to keep a record of every one of those. Because I could envision on election day some of these polling places where literally one person who should be doing other things spends all day writing down frivolous challenges in the poll book. Because I think that's what could happen now in this ruling. Am I being too apocalyptic about this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we don't know what these folks have planned. And, you know, the Republican Party knows what the rules are. And they claim, I've talked to one of their guys, that they're not planning on doing photography and blah, blah, blah. So, okay, we'll see. And they understand the challenging can't be frivolous. And you need a reason. Okay. So the judge comes along with this, well, you get to write them all down. And there, you know, the question is, can you just say, okay, that's a frivolous challenge. Go away. Give the ballot to the voter and write it down in the poll book. Can you do that? Or, and this is where he's vague, or does that mean no, you've got to go through the challenge process, even though it's frivolous. And now you've got a voter, which the rule is, if you've got a line of people, you take that person out of line, they go over there, they do all this stuff. In other words, hey, I was just going to drop in and vote. I didn't plan on spending a half hour here. So maybe I'll get back later today. Pain in the ass. I'm really out of it. So, you know, it's vague. That's just left pure and simple vague. Now, the other thing with that rule, you know, Benson made a comment about in this document that you can't challenge a voter's eligibility in an absent voter counting board. Now, you know, at first blush, that's a pretty bold statement, right? I mean, we've got this election law that talks about challenged voters. Well, the voter's not there, you know, so the voter can't respond to whether they're, you know, what their qualifications to vote on. And in all truthfulness, I can't recall anybody challenging a voter at the Detroit absent voter county board, you know, based on their qualifications. Because, you know, both you guys know the political world, you know what it would take to compile the data and have it organized well enough that some person standing at a table would be ready to file a challenge against this person because of return mail or whatever. When his name all of a sudden kind of very randomly pops up as that's, you know, Chris Thomas's ballot. These things are not in any kind of order. They're not in alpha order. They're in like a ballot number order. So, you know, it's a hard stretch to get there. And what she's saying is, yeah, you can challenge things ahead of the election. And you can challenge people's voter registration. You can do other things. But, you know, don't come to an absent voter counting board. So I'm sure that, you know, had some shock value to the judge that it said, oh, you know, you're now saying you can't do this. The reality was it's rarely, if ever, done.
Right. Well, on top of that, we all know, and our listeners should know, that by the time you get to the processing of a returned ballot at an AV board, that person's voter registration has been checked. Their signature has been checked twice. I mean, all that's been done. There's no basis to challenge the person's registration at that point after the ballot's been voted.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it's been wrapped up in a bowl.
Right. What do you, there's been a lot of controversy, a lot of talk about this legislation that finally passed that allows the, quote, pre-processing of absentee ballots. I can see you shaking your head. Our listeners can't see it, but I can see it. So tell us your take on that. What does the bill do? What the effect is going to be? And what do you think should be the rule when it comes to pre-processing of absentee ballots?
well, the bill, you know, is going to do what it did in 2020, which gives us a, you know, a couple steps off the blocks, you know, a head start. Not a whole lot more. It might save us a few hours at the end of the day. Because what it does, if I have a bunch of pre-processed ballots where I'm halfway through, we can open the envelope, we can check, you know, check the person, and we use the poll book in the AV County Board. Nobody else does, but we do. So we can, you know, scan the barcode, and then we can check the ballot number that's on the stub and in the e-poll book and make sure they're the same. And then we have to shove them back in the envelope, and that's it. We're done until election day. And then we open them up. So we're a little bit ahead of the game, right? So that means we can get ballots to the tabulators quicker. And so we have high-speed tabulators. Once they process 200 ballots, they take them over to the tabulator. So those guys start working earlier than they would normally. There's some savings, nothing huge. There are other bills that were attached to that. You know, one on, you know, deaths, getting dead voters off the files more efficiently. And, you know, everybody sort of accepted that a year ago. It wasn't a big deal. It brings the county clerks into it more. But it perpetuates this mythology. And the mythology is that there is a way to get every dead person off the rolls who have cast a ballot while they were alive and had the audacity to have that information takes to find its way to Michigan. This is not instantaneous information. And that's, you can die on the other side of the state, and it's going to take a week or two before it's back to your hometown. You know, the rule of law, you know, the law only says that precinct inspectors shouldn't count the ballots of people who have died if they have the knowledge. That's all the law says. Say anything about clerks or anything. And hey, look, the efforts, the good efforts, a good thing. But let's be honest, there are always going to be dead voters. And it's just the way it is. And, you know, there are states that say, look, if you're alive when you vote, your ballot counts. And that's what we do with petition signatures, right? You're alive when you sign that petition, man, you get to carry that forward if you die before it's canvassed. And we do it another way, too. It's not as immovable as death. But when you move from one city or township to another, within 60 days of the election and don't register in the new one, you can go back. You know, it's like a resurrection. You know, you go back and vote in your old community one last time, even though you're not going to pay those taxes on those issues. Those candidates may not be representing you, but you have appeared out of the ether. Come back in and vote one last time. And so it's much ado about nothing. And I know you can get shot for saying that today, but it really is.
Well, it's true, Chris. In addition to what you just said, this is such a tiny, tiny, tiny number.
Yeah.
I'll make that point. And frankly, I think in terms of the partisan impact, it probably breaks both ways. Yeah, Democratic voters die. So do Republican voters.
Yeah. We like consider death random, you know?
Yeah. Well, the studies show that Republicans die more often in October. This underscores, though, the point that the system, the laws, the courts, everything has been designed to protect the franchise of the voters.
Yes.
And that's been the preeminent concern from the entire system, is making sure your right to vote is protected. And we're talking about these now fairy tales that have arisen. I mean, they've been around forever, but they've been weaponized in a way since the 2020 election, during and since the 2020 election, that has really radicalized a large swath of people, the ones, several who we've mentioned here, who are conducting these trainings and leading these groups, like Pat Colbeck, who just live in a fantasy world where this isn't a piece of political rhetoric that they're trying to use to motivate their voters, they're actually believe this nonsense and think there's something nefarious afoot here. And they're going to be the ones that expose this and blow up the whole deep state system who's been trying to manipulate, you know, the outcome through fraudulent electoral or absentee ballots. The whole thing is just so nonsensical. I mean, it's when you get into this dead voter issue, it to me, it made me think of the census. The census count comes along once every 10 years. They count you, then they release the data by April 1st of the 2021 or 2011, whatever. But people have been born, have died, have moved. But great number of very important things are determined by that count that happens at a moment in time.
Yes.
When these people were alive and lived at these households. And the same thing with these few instances of people who you say have the audacity to die after they've cast their legal ballot. You know, I guess I've experienced elections that were a handful of votes. It could make a difference, but the courts have come down on the side of the franchise, the voter, and the voter's intent was clear in almost all of these instances.
Well, that's right. And if they pick up a rule someday, it isn't going to happen now because of all this, but it just says, hey, if you're alive when you voted, you know, and somebody can go back and check that maybe, but yeah, we're going to count your ballot, and then if it's a close election, that's the rule of law. Okay, no problem. What else did it do? Well, some Dropbox stuff in that package, and you know, it was all okay. There's sort of a chain of custody put in there. We in Detroit, we put ours under video back in 2020. I mean, we've had video coverage on our boxes all the way back since then. And then Ruth Johnson's thing got through about using these catch cards that military people can, and this all goes forward. It's not going to happen this year, that they can vote and use that, transmit their ballot over using that security device. But again, it's just that group. It's not their spouses. It's not their family. And certainly it's not any citizen overseas. But for that group of military, you know, it's a convenience and a good security thing. So, you know, those are the things that were in there. And what it didn't do is what this legislature hasn't done since 2018. Now, they came into lame duck right after the election. And, man, they made sure they tightened Prop 3 down as hard as they could. But they did not give the clerks what they need to run a heavy mail election. And that's what we observed in 2020. The number of unbalanced precincts. Detroit did okay. Once they came and audited us, we came up to, I don't know, 86, 87% being balanced. But out of all the jurisdictions in Wayne County, only 9 were balanced, within the 14 days after the election. It's because people were buried with ballots, and they had never processed 60% of their vote by mail. You know, they're in the low 20s or mid 20s in the past. So what does a modern system look like? Well, they pre-process. They tabulate during pre-processing. You know, Florida is the craziest state out there. And my hat's off to them. Even with the changes they made this year, hold some things back, still better than we are when it comes to certain things. Pre-processing, one of them, as soon as they do their logic and accuracy tests, which can be done early October once they have ballots, they start pre-processing. Ballots are received to go through tabulator 30 days out. I mean, it's Ohio. Here's a Republican state. Secretary of State sends everybody an AB application. Does that elect a whole bunch of Democrats? Not recently. Pre-process 17 days in advance of the elections and putting ballots through tabulators, doing early voting way out. I mean, come on. And, you know, in order to do, you cram all this into the one day, and of course everyone wants it done by midnight that day, you're going to have imbalances all over the place. And then you're going to see it again this year. It'll be better. Clerks have their legs under them a little better than they did 2020.
Right, but I think it's also important to note, Chris, that this fetish we've now developed with unbalanced precincts.
Oh, for God's sake.
Every vote has been counted in those precincts. It has nothing to do with the fact that the votes haven't been counted. No. It is like you said, some voter got a ballot, was standing in line to vote. I can't wait. I'm going home. And they took the ballot with them.
Yep.
Right? There's always, in my experience, and I've done recounts, and you've done a lot more than I have, there's virtually always some innocent explanation for why the precinct is unbalanced. Nothing nefarious whatsoever.
No, and it's, you know, it's stuff like people, you know, they don't sign their ballot. Oh, it's been checked in already on the QDF, so they send them another ballot. It comes back. They don't get the thing wiped off properly. Oh, it looks like there's two ballots now. I mean, it's just, it's the minutia of volume that gets you every time. And you just need time to do that in a reasonable fashion. And so, you know, that's part and parcel of what election officials need to run this. Election officials didn't go out and put that issue on the ballot. They're the recipients of that. And even though the legislature never would have passed that, come hell or high water, they still ought to respect the fact that 2/3 of the voters voted for that. It is part of the Constitution. They take the same oath and do something about it.
Speaking of volume, if I can, we've seen these efforts, and I think they're bearing fruit, by the Republicans and other groups to recruit election workers. Yeah. And we're not talking about challengers or people observing. These are the actual people who on election day or in these AV counting boards actually do the processing of the ballots we've been discussing. And there seems to have been a real upsurge in folks. I think it's been uneven across the state. But we've also seen in some of these trainings, people like Colbeck and others urging these people to be spies. Ryan Kelly basically last summer urged people to be saboteurs by unplugging voting machines. Give us, you know, your perspective on, you know, is this effort working? Are we getting more Republican poll workers? And how do you think that's going to play out on election day?
Right now I'm going to give it high marks. And I'm going to say, bring it on. we had them in August. And I talked to the young man that runs all that operation at the RNC, brought in to, you know, do all this. We've been in quite a bit of contact over the last year. I said, okay. I said, well, he never got a call. He said, every one of these people has a cell phone. Not one of them called him up and said, hey, guess what? Now, I understand the Republican Party didn't have a lot at stake on the August primary ballot in the city of Detroit. So, you know, we'll see this November, but, you know, the people came in, they were distributed around so that each of the tables, we had 120 then, at least one Republican at every one, adjudication where you look at overvotes to decide whether it's properly done or we've always, even back 2020, we had one Republican, one Democrat, same with a duplication board. And, you know, you guys have been there. It's like watching paint dry. It is not very exciting. It's a long day. And, you know, so my concern is, do they come back? You know, it's nice. They're nice that's here. I'm glad they're here. And maybe they'll come back for 24, depending on, you know, who's running. But is that the last time we see them?
Now, sunlight is the best antidote to a lot of this nonsense. When people are exposed to what actually happens, they find out that there's not a lot of problems. But we're assuming that facts or truth matter to this process and the people who are involved in manipulating it. And that's a whole different argument. One thing that concerns me, and I know we're nearing the end of our time, is the way that what was dubbed in 2020 and is we're likely to see again called the Red Mirage, meaning how the election day votes, especially in smaller rural areas that tend to vote more Republican, are going to be reported first and hit the news, social media, and everyone's going to be talking about, and it's going to show leads, kind of a snapshot in time, because the voting is all done for Republican candidates. And then, you know, it fits into this, you know, Trump narrative, and then thousands of votes come in Detroit and everything changes. We're going to be up against that again. It's just the way the process works by not having this early counting of absentee votes. You know, this, I guess, any comments or observations that you want to add to that?
Well, I will say this. We are going to put in partials out. So I don't know what time or how, but, you know, by the time we get, let's just say, for example, I mean, this is okay, that we aim for 11 for midnight, right? That's kind of legit as to when all the polling place stuff is in and some of the AVs. I bet you we would be able to dump 80 to 90% of the Detroit results.
So, yeah, I want to be clear here to our listeners, Chris. When you say we, you're referring to the Detroit results because you are now part of and have been part of the Detroit absentee voting counting process, right?
Yeah, and I forget that old joke about what's this we stuff. Yeah. Detroit elections. And they did in 2020. It ended up taking much longer, and all this was a new process. So it wasn't the wee hours before they were out there. But I think we'll have something, a substantial portion of the Detroit returns, the mail returns, before midnight. And I think that'll at least cut in. And I know some others, maybe Lansing and some of the others, are planning to do that as well.
Right.
And it was kind of interesting. There was a bill at one time. They wanted to prohibit that. It's like, why the hell would you prohibit that? You know, it's like they want to perpetuate the Red Mirage. I don't know. It was the strangest bill I saw.
No, you're right, Chris, because for decades, predating you and me, there have been partial precinct results, right? Yeah. This set of precincts is in, but we're waiting for these. Sure. And people didn't hesitate to release those, and those are the same thing as partial returns from an AV board.
Exactly. And, you know, until 2020, I mean, nobody, as I recall, was ever releasing partial AVs. You know, they always waited till the entire thing was done.
So, right.
Well, it's, you know, it's to me, I mean, there was a point in time when there was a semblance of normalcy, a semblance, I'll give it in our politics. And having you doing what you're doing for the city of Detroit would have shut a lot of people up, would have taken the political myth, the rhetoric that's been used by the Republicans for a long time. I'll have to include myself in that. And it would have said, okay, you got an impartial, respected, neutral observer. There's like the UN sending in a peacekeeper in a way, you know, when with Chris Thomas is there, okay, we know nothing nefarious is going on because he would never stand for something like that. And so I'm glad that you're there. I know that people who really pay attention to what's going on, reporters, they understand this. Thank you for what you're doing. Restoring the faith in the shared faith in our democracy is critical to the continuation of our democracy. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen this month. It's going to be a process, but it takes people willing to weather the arrows that are going to be flung at you to do it. So hats off to you, Chris.
I appreciate it. And I appreciate you guys, you know, being a way to get this word out. It's going to be a long road back. And, you know, we've gone against hundreds of millions of dollars perpetuating. So it's going to take some time.
Well, I join Jeff, Chris. Thank you so much. when you should be enjoying your well-deserved retirement after an extraordinary career. You're such a patriot, a real patriot, that you're willing to come out of retirement for the last several years and do this. So on behalf of all the people of Michigan, thank you for what you're doing.
Well, I enjoy what I'm doing, and it's a pleasure to talk with you guys.
Time's up for this week's discussion, with special thanks to Chris Thomas for sharing his tremendous knowledge of elections and election law.
And we love hearing from our listeners. Email us at arepublicpodcast@gmail.com. We thank you all, our listening audience, for the tremendous growth that we've had in the podcast. Our weekly downloads have nearly doubled in the last couple of months, and we are appreciative of your loyalty as well as the guests that are willing to come on and be grilled by Jeff and I.
Early voting is well underway in Michigan and across the country. In Michigan, you can still request an absentee ballot from your local clerk or vote in person at the clerk's office. And you can help keep this podcast going when you check out the Merch Center. Just click on the merch store link on our homepage. The website is arepublicpodcast.com.
And if the Republic is still standing, we'll be back next week with our last chat before Election Day. I'm Mark Brewer.
And I'm Jeff Timmer. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on all major podcast sites. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.